Welcome to a Modern Nonprofit Podcast, powered by the Charity CFO, your compass for creative solutions in running your nonprofit. I'm Tasha Anderson, your host and guide through this nonprofit maze. From fundraising to volunteer management, we've got your back. Join us each episode for fresh, game-changing strategies that can make a real impact. Hey everyone, welcome back. We have another episode of A Modern Nonprofit Podcast. I'm Tasha Anderson, the host, and today I have a new friend with me, Tamala Aldridge. Thank you for joining us, Tamala. Tamala, you are the executive director of an organization of Only Make Believe. I'm so excited to dive into your story. And I should say, Tamala, we don't always have a lot of executive directors of nonprofits on this podcast, but occasionally I just like to sprinkle those in and highlight what is an actual executive director that's actually doing the work right here, right now, doing what's their story, what's their challenges, what keeps them inspired and keeps them doing the hard fight that you all are doing every single day. So thank you for taking time out of your extraordinarily busy schedule to join us here today.
No, thank you, Tasha. It's my pleasure to be with you today. And I'm looking forward to speaking with you. As an executive director, what am I doing now? I think most executive directors would agree. We juggle lots of things.
All of the things.
But the most important thing has to be the passion for the mission, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm. Keeping that first and forefront. Tell us a little bit more about, just to set the ground for those that are listening, tell us a little bit more about your organization, Only Make Believe, and kind of what you all do and what you kind of specialize in, just to set the groundwork a little bit.
Oh, great. Only Make Believe creates and performs interactive theater for children who have medically fragile conditions, mm-hmm. children who have developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. And what's so special about what we do is that we meet children where they are. So we bring our performances to hospitals, we bring our performances to care facilities, and to special education programs. So I think we make theater accessible to them by meeting them where they are.
I love that. Little known fact about me, Tamala, before I started this firm, it's been about 8 years almost to the day. And, but before I did that, before I started this firm, I worked as a CFO of a nonprofit, and that organization, their largest program was with medically fragile, you know, children, also with some element of developmental disabilities. And I was fortunate enough to tag along with some field trips, and occasionally we would take the kids out to, what would they call it? Like music camp. And it was so fun to see children that were suffering from like seizure disorders or, just really significant medical needs that they weren't always incredibly responsive or had a high degree of alertness, right? Because of brain injuries or other things. And to watch them really start to be more aware, or just kind of their little movements and things while listening to the music and just, you know, the energy around. And it makes a really big difference. And I have really fond memories of thinking back on, you know, I think children that otherwise would not have had a chance to have this kind of experience, and through like music and rhythm or any other sort of performing arts, even if they don't have, you know, or if even if they suffer from like visual impairments or hearing impairments, as some of the kids that we did, that we had in our program did, even just the movement or the vibrations on the ground, because all of our kids were non-ambulatory, so they could feel like the movement as they sit in their chairs and things. It was really cool. So kudos to you for doing work in that space. So,
everyone has an imagination. Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you are dealing with medical conditions or if you have a developmental disability. We all have imaginations, and we take in information differently. So it's always been interesting to me, you know, years starting out as an actor, I always studied human behavior. So then working with these specialized populations, it was truly intriguing to me how these young people engaged and how they interpreted the information, and then how they were able to then push it back out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you kind of hinted on your life before you became a leader of a nonprofit. I always like to ask this question every time I talk to somebody that's working with or in the nonprofit space. How did you get into this situation? How did you end up here? You said you were an actor before. And that's always a funny story because it's a good conversation starter.
So I was an actor for many years. I lived in New York City. And only make believe, actually, I started with them as an actor in 2008.
Oh, okay.
So we hire professional actors. So these are actors that you've seen on Broadway, in regional theaters, in television, film. And because we know that they have a skill set that is quite unique to reach our population. So I was fortunate enough to audition and I became a member of the acting company in New York.
Oh, and cool.
It was, you know, aside from whether I was doing a theater job or a television job or a film job, you know, as a up and coming actor, you always had to have a stable job. So I thought only make believe was really cool because our founder, her name is Dina Hammerstein. She's part of the Hammerstein Musical Theater family.
Okay.
And she was an actress as well in her early career. So when she started this organization, she was adamant about paying actors because so many times artists are asked to give their gifts of their talents. So, you know, and she was like, no, this is like people have training. This is a skill set. This is a gift and it has a value. And so I love the fact of being a part of this organization. And it was a part of, it was honestly, it was my part of my creative economy. It was my stabilization. It was my stabilization.
So you were, you know, and you had an acting career and, you know, you were a parent. And so I'm sure, you know, the connection with children and creating programming for children that otherwise wouldn't have it, it resonates with you. I'm really curious how you made that transition and like, what was the biggest learning curve for you? Or like looking back now, like, wow, I can't believe I, you know, survived that because running a whole organization, especially a nonprofit organization, is tremendous. I just had another conversation earlier with someone that says that when you step into leading a nonprofit, it's essentially the equivalent of stepping into a publicly traded company with a board, with audits, with public scrutiny, with the need to perform, with the need to measure everything and report out on everything and have all of the opinions coming at you. I thought that was an incredible analogy. And especially for someone, it's not that you came with a whole business degree or you started with an organization and you eventually, you know, worked your way up and you learned bits and pieces of the operation. That must have been a huge like shock for you, I would guess.
It was. So, I mean, yes, I was an actor, but I graduated from Howard University many years
ago. Oh, great.
And my father and my parents were very supportive of me going into the arts. But my father was just like, but you need to have a backup plan.
Okay.
So I actually got my degree in arts administration.
Oh,
which was great because as an actor, you need to know how to market yourself. You need to know how to manage your finances. You need to know how to handle business. I had a professor in college, Henry Edmonds, Dr. Henry Edmonds, and she would say, the word is show business, but before you can ever do a show, you have to be able to handle your business.
Oh, wow.
So I've always had that about me. And so working with Only Make Believe, I think the biggest pivot for me as an actor and then making a choice to go into this direction as an executive director was my husband and I found out we were going to be parents. I was pregnant. And he lived in Washington, D.C. I lived in New York. And, you know, we've been married for 3 years. You know, it was great. It was always a honeymoon when we saw each other, right?
Right.
Once my daughter was on the way, we'd made the decision for me to move to Washington, D.C. It just so happened that a board member from New York, her husband got a position with the federal government. So she was relocating her family here. So the founder of the organization and the executive director at the time approached us and was like, what do you all think about doing an expansion in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to be honest with you, Tasha. I grabbed onto it like it was a lifeline. And I'm going to tell you why. Because I was moving. I'd been in New York for 15 years. I knew what that life was, right? And I'd been married for 3 years, but it had been a commuter marriage. So I felt like I was uprooting everything, going into this on this new journey. And to have something that I know, that I know what this is, I can do this, to kind of anchor me as I'm in this new environment, I grabbed onto it. So I was 7.5 months pregnant, and me and the board member here, her name is Sarah Roseanne, we just contacted some facilities, health facilities here in DC for children, and we auditioned some actors at her Jewish school where her son was going. We got a conference room, auditioned actors. I hired five actors. I taught them all the shows that I knew, set up a schedule, and then I went on maternity leave. But I felt that gave me a creative outlet as I was in this new environment. I was in my last trimester of pregnancy, so it helped to ground me. And so I had my daughter April 1st, 2012. And around July, the executive director at the time contacted me, and she's like, "So, what are your plans? What are you thinking of doing?" And I said, "I just really have no idea. I don't know the theater landscape here. I've lived here once before when I was in undergraduate school, but that's been so many years ago." And she said, "Because we really need someone there on the ground to keep it going. What you got going was great. We need someone to keep it going, but if you don't want to do that, we'll respect it." But I was just like, "Well, you know what? Because I'm still figuring out mommyhood. I'm very much sleep deprived." I was like, "Let me stay with this because, again, it gives me myself an identity. Still as Tamla, not just as mommy, not just as wife, but still Tamla." So I started doing that, and the program in DC just grew and grew and grew, and I didn't know what I was doing. I'm gonna be honest with you. I learned how to write grants on the fly, but I think what really helped me is my viewpoint of how I work based upon my theater training. So
What's that?
even though I'm an executive director, I still very much think in an ensemble way of working. I cannot do this by myself. I do not have all the answers. I cannot generate all the ideas. So I think having that level of, and just being honest and open, very transparent. And I would say to people all the time, the things that I know, I know. But there are a lot of things that I don't know. And I actually met someone who worked at the DC Commission for the Arts and Humanities. He actually sat down with me and told me like the outlines of writing a good grant. So just finding those support systems naturally, and I'm just thinking of working in an ensemble sort of way for the good of the organization so that we can continue to serve as many kids as possible.
I'm really inspired hearing your story, especially in light of, and I'm sure you've seen it, all of the kind of articles coming out about the burnout at the leadership level within nonprofit organizations, especially women. You said earlier before I hit record that, you made a very intentional choice to enter the nonprofit space. And it sounds like you make intentional choices every day when you keep showing up and continuing this work. Share with me a little bit more about maybe what you think that intentional choice and maybe not having that intentional choice, or if you've thought about that at all, and like why there's so many people burning out on this industry.
Okay, so the first part, the intentional choice. I think I made the intentional choice to focus on this rather than trying to be a freelance actor again after I became a parent. And in the first 3 years of my daughter's life, we had several hospital visits. And so I ended up getting the other end of what the other experience that parents get when their children are in hospitals. So then that I already enjoyed engaging and playing with the children, but that gave me another level of you know, the impact we're
Understanding.
having. You know, as a nervous mom, my daughter has RSV and, you know, has to have these, she's in this confined container, and all I can do is reach in and touch her hand. And we are watching an only make-believe performance that was happening within the hospital. And I'm just like, what we're doing is for me as a mother at that point, it helped me keep my stress down. It helped me make this less stressful for my child. We were singing, like you said, the music, the dancing. We were singing and enjoying the show. And it just resonated with me on such a, you know, visceral level. That I think that's when I made the intentional choice that it's great to make kids smile. It's great to bring them joy. But also what I found in that time, because even though she couldn't call into the show because she was isolated, the actors were asking questions and she was responding. And even in that moment in time when she really didn't have control of anything, I felt like this really gave her a moment of empowerment because she could engage in the way that she wanted to
respond.
Engage.
Yeah.
So I think at that moment, I was just like, yeah, I'm all in for Only Make Believe. And how can we serve as many people as possible? Because I actually think now that this is the most best kept secret for almost 20 years. Nobody really knows about this organization that founded in New York in 1999. So that's when I made the intentional choice to step on this track. Now, burnout is real. And, you know, I think burnout was real prior to the pandemic. But after the pandemic, I've just kind of seen people actually leave the nonprofit sector.
Right.
Because it's so much, and like you said, it's so much accountability, it's so much evaluation, it's so much, you know, fundraising driven goals. You know, it's a lot that you have to do. And as an ED, especially in a smaller nonprofit, you know, I'm the executive director, I'm the artistic director, I'm director of human resources. So, you know, all these things, I'm learning all these things. I'm learning them in real time. And I think what was really helpful for me is that, especially as the pandemic descended upon us, our board was like in transition. Because we did all in-person programming, you know, we knew that during this time of isolation, the populations that we served needed us more than anything. So we were able to, you know, just start doing some type of virtual content. You know, there was no blueprint, there was no plan because nobody would see this was going to happen. But the board members who stayed on were really committed to it, to where we were able to not only keep the organization going, but now, in addition to being able to return to in-person programming, we have this robust virtual programming that's in 16 cities now.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And I think, you know, you hinted on a couple of things, like, you know, certainly you have your art administration background. So I will apologize in advance. I misjudged you. I work with a lot of creatives, and all the things that you mentioned about, you know, what your professor taught you about show business, emphasis on the business. I meet a lot of amazing creatives, and I always try to tell my team, look, there's two sides of the brain, okay? And there's the creative side, and there's the side that we typically operate. So give grace to creatives because they just don't think this way. So I misjudged you when you said studied acting and I was an actor. So kudos to you for kind of embracing that. And we can do a whole nother episode on that alone. But you are, for as a leader, especially of an evolving organization or a smaller organization that doesn't have every function built out and a huge budget to pay for all these things. What I find what really attributes a lot of that burnout is that you have to learn things on the fly and you have to spend a lot of your time oftentimes doing things you're not necessarily good at, or at least you don't feel like you're good at. You're not necessarily comfortable. You don't know how to do it. You have to figure it out. And a lot of times that means things that are taking you away from what you like really love, right? So you mentioned you're kind of the executive director, director of HR, director of all these things, and also the artistic director. Obviously, being an actor, the artistic side is probably what is, you know, feels more natural. But then when you have to figure out marketing and board development and, you know, fundraising and, you know, compliance with different grants and HR issues and like all of the things, moving one organization from, you know, operating in New York to Washington, D.C. and all the compliance around that, you know, from, you know, just a geographic standpoint, it's a lot. And I think that is definitely a point of frustration or just certainly a large contributor to the burnout.
Yeah,
in this space.
I agree. And it is, I think you said something, you hit the nail on the head when you said you're figuring things out in real time, things you don't know, or things you kind of don't really feel like you're doing well. You're
right.
excelling at.
Right.
And I find that two things with that. Here in Washington, D.C., there's an organization that supports nonprofits called Spur Local.
Mm-hmm.
And during the pandemic, they created a cohort of executive directors where we would get together once a week and just release. Because nobody understood it more, you know, better than the executive director. And so that cohort actually has become my, you know, my alliance.
Support group. Yeah.
It's become my alliance. We still meet. We met last week. We still meet. We still run questions by each other. We're thought leaders amongst each other. How can we do this better? And how can we not be so hard on ourselves? And I think one thing I shared with them, because again, I'm the only creative in it, is I work from transparency. So I never walk in the room acting like I know I got this.
Right.
I walk in the room like I'm a stakeholder in this organization, just like everyone else.
Right.
And if someone has an idea, let's take that idea. Let's ruminate on it. Let's get us some strategies and then some methods of how we can implement it. And I work from that vantage point. I think that relieves some of the stress. I won't say all of the stress.
Mm-hmm.
It relieves some of the stress of feeling like everything is on my shoulders.
Right.
I also think, you know, having a good, not just a good relationship, having good communication with your board is essential. Because a lot of times what I've come to know about executive directors, it's the stress of feeling like you have to justify every decision that you make to this board, to this body of people who are not in the day-to-day.
Right.
And they don't know. And and it took time. I mean, the relationship I have with my board, I've been the executive director since 2018. It's done a complete 180.
Wow.
You know, it's not a complete 180. And I will also be, you know, to be honest with you, as a woman of color, serving as an executive director. And then when I go to my first board meeting, I'm the only person of color there.
Right.
And the majority of the board members are white males. So it's just like, but seeing people for who they are, we're all here for a collective reason.
Mm-hmm.
Let's focus on that collective reason. And I think that's how we get over the quote unquote expectations we have of the roles
in
the organization.
I can see that when you know what you're talking about, being an executive director and completely, you know, probably subconsciously or unintentionally, I think by default, having a little bit of like a defensive posture, because you do have to explain, you have to answer all of the questions. You have to keep your staff happy. You have to keep your funders happy. You have to keep your board happy. And then when people start asking all these questions, you can't help but to think, okay, well, I'm explaining this and this is my decision, but you're asking me this for a reason. So, you know, it's just kind of human nature to start thinking about, why did they ask me that? Was that a wrong decision? You know, and because you're just constantly overwhelmed with inquiries and questions and problems that you need to put out or, you know, fires that you need to put out. It's a lot. It's overwhelming. And I love this conversation because I think a lot of people step into the nonprofit space. And I read a statistic that was posted like August of 2023, so not that long ago, that said that the nonprofit industry has the highest turnover of any industry, like any industry period, which, you know, you can blame it on money and things of that nature, certainly, right? But then also I was kind of thinking about what else is kind of contributing to that. And from my perspective, you know, I used to work for a nonprofit. I have several employees that have chosen to kind of leave, you know, serving in the nonprofit space directly, right? And I have a lot of nonprofits that call me because they've had turnover too many times, like in their accounting and finance function, and they're picking up the phone and trying to, you know, find a more permanent solution because of that ongoing anticipated turnover. And, you know, I think it's just the constant pressure, at least in my experience, was just the constant pressure from all of these different angles that really is almost just too much, and feeling like it's hard for you to say, I just don't know the answer, or I need help, and you don't know where to get the help. And by the way, you're spending all of your days on this like hamster wheel of things. You don't know what you're doing. You're trying to figure it out. You're building the plane while you're flying it. Meanwhile, being pestered or peppered with all of the questions,
right.
And having all of the doubts and insecurity. And I share all this because this is a good, bad, and the ugly. It's extraordinarily rewarding. And I said, fine, I'm not going to serve the nonprofit community in this way, but I still have a commitment. Like you, I had a very intentional commitment very early on in my career. This is what I feel like I'm called to do. And as rewarding and amazing as it is, it does come with its own set of real challenges. And people should know that.
It does. You should want to be here. You know, I think that there are people who land in the nonprofit space, and I don't know if they really want to be here.
They think they did maybe originally, and they maybe find out.
Yeah, and that's okay. You know, that's all right. You know, this organization has experienced turnover, but I'm also proud to say, you know, I'm going on my, 16th year? With this organization, my operations director has been here 12 years. My director of programming has been here 12 years. So, you know, I'm proud of the fact that, you know, some key roles have stayed here. And again, they made an intentional choice.
To stay here.
And
that helps.
Growing pains are real. You know, if it's challenging, you're doing something right.
Yeah, that's true.
You're doing something right. So, and instead of, you know, just keeping pressing forward, what are we doing right? And what's really working here? And then how can we gradually build upon that based upon the bandwidth that we have?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's having that conversation, because I think everybody sees the end goal and they're ready to be there tomorrow. I'm ready to be there tomorrow. You know, I see this organization bigger and better than, you know, my imagination can hold. Do we have a infrastructure footprint to support that right now? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
You know, when you were describing that, you know, if you're feeling the way that I interpret it, is if you're feeling uncomfortable, if it feels hard, you're doing something right. And I think I know I have at different times, either working in the nonprofit space or shoot, even running my own business. It's like, I'm waiting for it to get easy. And I've just accepted if it's easy, you should pause and maybe be a little concerned, or just frankly change your mindset and set your expectations reasonably, because it's probably not going to get easy, because even if you don't change things for yourself, the world has a way of changing things for us. Right. So, and speaking of like, forward thinking and kind of seeing what your goals are, I'm curious, what are your goals kind of for your organization? Where do you see it heading kind of in the near or kind of distant future?
We've already accomplished that. I wanted it to become a nationwide organization.
Thank you, pandemic.
And the pandemic, the silver lining of virtual programming, we have become a nationwide organization. I want to expand on that with our in-person performances too. So we have a headquarters in New York. We have a DC office. I do foresee in the future having an office on the West Coast, and maybe somewhere in Middle America, because I just do think that the virtual program is fantastic, but you can never beat an in-person experience. So I still want to bring the inspiration, the imagination to as many children as possible in person. So that's the bigger goal. And I think what we learned from our expansion with DC is before you just, set up a shop and put up a sign, you really have to make sure you have the support in that area for that work. So I think that's where the virtual program is actually really going to help us. Where we can do shows. We're actually in one children's theater, I mean children's hospital now in the California area in Orange County, where they're already learning about only make-believe. So then I'm thinking of looking at, businesses in that area who support that children's hospital and introducing, we're only make-believe. We're already there virtually. We'd love to be there in person. Can we have a talk and see if there's an alignment or a partnership? I wish we would have thought about that before when we did see. We wouldn't have had, some of the headaches we had in starting DC until it settled itself while it grew. But I think that's where the virtual program is really going to be an asset for us to reach that goal. And, every stakeholder for Only Make Believe, the vision is to serve as many children as possible. So I think this is important too. I think every executive director has a shelf life. I think you figure out what it is you want to make your goals while you're in this position that you can hang your hat on and say, this is what I helped this organization accomplish. And it's fine for you to pass the baton to someone else to take it to the next level. I think
That's yeah, that's good. Well, and it makes you think, and as somebody that's a founder and, the managing partner of my firm, but I know that eventually I'm going to pass the reins on. And I think this is important for any business owner. I would say, especially a founder that's an executive director of a nonprofit, figuring out, answering that question for yourself. Like, what is the goal? What is the threshold? Where is the point where you're like, I am satisfied with this, and now it's time to hand it on to someone else? Succession planning has always been a hot conversation in the nonprofit space, but and of course finding somebody to take over is related, but kind of a separate issue in my mind. It's the executive director, or whoever's leading the organization, any organization, asking themselves that hard question: when is it time for me to pass the baton? And working towards that, and just being mindful of when that is, and starting to create some of that succession planning when you know that you're kind of nearing that. So that's an interesting question, figuring out when that is.
figuring out when that is. And again, giving yourself some grace in that, because you also have to think about what then will be your next journey. I think a lot of times, because we're so inundated with so many responsibilities, we just think about how I'm going to do this for 2 more years and then I'm going to find something else. And if you don't know what that something else is for you, why put a time limit on what you can give right now? And again, being so just meticulous about what is your goal, what's the lasting legacy and impact I would love for my leadership to have in this organization? And I spoke had a meeting with our governance. The chair of our governance committee, and we were talking about this, and I was like, succession planning is a hot, so it's a buzzword. I said, but it's real, and this organization is bigger than any of us who are involved in it. So what steps are we taking? to where if Tamala isn't here, if this board chair isn't here, if this organization will maintain. So I feel like the last, especially 2.5 years, it really has been about codifying the OMB program.
Right.
And really making record of it. Like, you know, I learned on the fly. All of this institutional knowledge in my head cannot walk out the door.
That's right. Yeah.
It cannot walk. Otherwise, the organization will always be treading water.
I see that all the time. All the time. I mean, obviously, I see it mostly on the accounting financial side, but I know that I've seen this, you know, especially when I work for a nonprofit or even I hear from our clients, every key function of their business, so much of that. We're working so quickly, we're learning on the fly, we're fixing things as we go along, and there's really no record of it. So that when, I mean, even just things like how to bill invoices for key funders, no one has any idea, right? How to use certain key functions of a software, no one has any idea. Where these records are housed, no, it's just, we take for granted how much we keep in our minds until the people that are left remaining after that person leaves is kind of scrambling to get things in order. It's a real challenge. And it's hard for us to slow down and, like you said, start codifying some of these things, but it really is important.
It really is.
For that next generation, for sure.
I tell my staff, you know, this train doesn't stop. You know, we constantly have programming happening, right?
Sure.
We're constantly doing outreach to supporters and funders. But we also have to do what I call this, we have to clean up the house. We have to clean up the house. I think when you step outside the door, it's wonderful what we do. But we have to make sure once we invite people in, whether that's new team members, new board members, new stakeholders, period, that they're coming into a well-kept and organized space.
Yeah. That makes sense. I have one last question for you, because I know I'm always doing this. I'm always running out of time. But I was having a conversation earlier about doing more with less. And you talk about this expansion, and so many organizations are trying to figure out how to do more with programming, understanding some of the challenges with funding issues or rising expenses or fill in the blank, you know, can't find the right talent, that sort of thing. So your expansion plan, is that following the trend of trying to do more with less, or kind of what is your strategy for that expansion? I'm just curious about that.
Well,
that's a big goal. Yeah.
That's a big goal. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough that our partners in the children's hospitals, a lot of them have their own audiovisual technological capabilities.
Oh,
so
yeah.
We can just live stream. But it somewhat limits our artistic choice because, you know, hospital staffs are already, again, they're a lot like the nonprofit space, right?
Right.
A lot of turnover has happened.
They're
exhausted. And though the programming OMB provides is great, you know, they don't have an artistic background, you know?
Right.
A lot of people, a lot of times these staff members are part of the child life department. So, you know, they're thinking, I need to just hit this button. Whereas if we really want to use, if Only Make Believe really wants to use our virtual programming to just be the driving force behind our expansion, we need to be able to have artistic control and codification of what that virtual programming looks like. So it is right now we're working on getting funding to here in our DC office. We just moved. We have a large multi-purpose room building our own digital studio.
Oh, neat. Well, and so, I asked that question because when you talk about, you know, plugging in virtually to all of these different hospitals all over the country and just getting those commitments and getting that collaboration and participation with those hospitals, what an incredible reach you can have that I would imagine to some degree can be duplicated without the extreme cost of setting up shop in each one of these places.
Exactly.
And that's why I thought of, you know, doing a lot more with, I wouldn't say less, but without adding much more, right? So like huge gains without huge gains in expenses. So I mean, that kudos to you.
When you think about opening up another office, That's going to run you, hundreds of thousands of dollars a
Extremely
year
expensive.
to
Yes.
maintain.
Right.
Whereas with this virtual studio, it may cost us $100,000 to
Right.
build, but once it's built, we have
Right. One time. Yeah.
One time.
Yeah.
One time.
You can use it over and over again.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, Tamla, this has been such a cool conversation. I love talking to leaders like you that are just in the trenches every day, trying to do really out of the box thinking and just being really creative about how do we expand programming in light of all of the challenges we face, whether it's geographic limitations, funding limitations. And it's really cool to see you choosing a very specific population you want to work with a very specific program that you're trying to offer, and rather than just keep adding a bunch of different programs that might support this population, or taking the creative side and just making it even more accessible to other people. I love your kind of duplicating model, hopefully nationwide and hopefully in partnerships with Children's Hospital. I will say I have another client that's out on the West Coast that had a not the same programming at all, but a similar model of partnering with Children's Hospitals. And it's really cool. They're on the West Coast, but I went to the Children's Hospital here in St. Louis, and sure enough, I saw their name there. I was like, look, so it's totally doable. They've been able to do this all over the country, and I believe that'll happen for you too. But I do wonder if people want to follow along with your story and just see how you all are kind of progressing with your goals. What is the best way people can reach out to you? How do they find you?
Oh, they can go to our website, and it's really easy, onlymakebelieve.org.
Onlymakebelieve.org.
Yeah, they can find out about us. We have our contact information if, they want to get involved in their area, and it's not just New York and D.C. We have volunteer opportunities for anyone in those 16 cities, actually anyone in the nation.
Okay.
So, they can find out more about us at onlymakebelieve.org.
Onlymakebelieve.org.
I have to give you your props, Tasha.
Oh.
I'm going to be honest with you. Now that I've been in the nonprofit space for more than 10 years, this is a resource that really is needed, and that you've made the commitment to serve the nonprofit industry in this way. It's really remarkable. Because I would hope that whether it's an executive director or just any nonprofit professional, if they could take something from these podcasts to re-energize them, help them work smarter, not harder, to inspire them to fight that good fight, whatever it is, for whatever mission they're so passionate about. So thank you for your commitment to the nonprofit space and creating this synergy.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I never publicly said those specific words, but that was really my vision for this podcast and for all people listening, that, I meet these really cool people that have found really creative ways of solving these really hard problems. And I meet so many nonprofits that are just trying to like recreate the wheel time and time again. And they want to learn better ways, but they just don't simply have the time to do it. So I thought, why don't I just start recording these conversations and making them accessible for people? And then not only putting them on a podcast, but putting them on a search engine like YouTube, which, by the way, anyone listen, go to YouTube and subscribe, because then people can search for, national programming virtually, or, any other issue that they might be trying to find a solution for. And the more that we build resources like this, I hope that it makes our lives a little bit easier. I always say this, the work is hard enough. Why make it even harder? So hopefully, sharing these stories helps. If not finding the solution, stories like yours, that helps inspire people. So thank you for sharing that. Thank you for seeing that. Yeah.
Thank you. This has been very enjoyable. Time has flown by.
Yes, yes. Well, you heard it straight from Tamla. Go check out the content. If this is your first podcast, check out other podcasts. I think we're up to 80-something episodes. But we also have content over on our YouTube channel. And wherever you find us, all I say is just to engage it in some way. For those of you that don't know, just engaging it, liking, subscribing, whatever makes this content more searchable and therefore easier to find for other nonprofit leaders like yourself to get access to these resources. So Tamla, thank you again for joining us, and
thank
for
you,
everyone
Tasha.
Listening. We will see you next time. Bye.
That's all we have for you today. Once again, I'm Tasha Anderson with the Charity CFO, and this is A Modern Nonprofit Podcast. Make sure to subscribe to A Modern Nonprofit Podcast on all major streaming platforms so you will stay notified for when the latest episode drops, which will help you stay in the know about anything nonprofit related. Also, join our community on Facebook by searching for A Modern Nonprofit Podcast and follow us on all of our social media accounts. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.